Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 65, Tackling Genetic Disease.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there to get the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that will end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
Okay, so let's start the show. This is Futures in Biotech, and I'm Mark Peltier. Today, I'm going to preface this introduction because our guest was my PhD mentor, and so I was in his lab from 1996 to 2001. And since that's the case, and we've kind of known each other for a long, long time, I've invited Dr. Dave Brodbeck to co-host the show and keep us on track and to avoid too much insider baseball. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Mark. My knowledge of biochemistry is basically limited to the fact that it exists.
Well, that's good.
Yep.
That's good because my dad's listening and we need to explain it to my dad.
Okay.
And, you know, keep the questions coming because Dave and I have been go a long way back and we could end up talking about the inner workings of a protein folding quality control machinery and, you know, and find it super interesting. So you've got to keep it interesting.
I'll do what I can. Thanks for the pressure.
Yeah, so Dave Thomas, I met him. He was running a large group at the National Research Council of Canada. And had a lot of great folks in it, in that group, including Malcolm Whiteway, who's a phenomenal yeast geneticist, teaches yeast genetics at Cold Spring Harbor. He's actually going to be on the show in October, right? And so he's from the same group that as McPherson, who taught us X-ray crystallography a couple of episodes back. Also in that group, Andre Nautel, who has been on FIB many times, talked about DNA, microarrays, Neanderthal genomics, and you know, he's really co-hosted a number of shows and has been excellent. He's also from the Thomas Lab. But Dave has this great ability to pull some amazing people together. While he was at the National Research Council of Canada, he discovered one of the key underpinnings of how proteins fold and traffic correctly in the cell. And this describes a common mechanism of about 120 diseases, including Gaucher's, emphysema, and cystic fibrosis. In 2000, Dave left the National Research Council. I was the only one to actually follow. It was a lab of about 30 to 35, and I trekked along across town in Montreal over to McGill with him. And he took on the position of chair of biochemistry. And building on his understanding of protein folding and trafficking, he initiated a chemical biology program to tackle cystic fibrosis, which is a huge, huge challenge. So welcome to the show, Dave.
Thank you, Mark. That's very nice indeed. Yeah. So my only thing that I want to say is that I always followed what somebody told me once. I think it was Peter Medawar. Always hire people better than you are. And that seems to work pretty well, at least so far.
Yeah, no, definitely. I try to do that too. I've been shadowing your work for years. Everything you do, I tend to say, well, he's doing chemical biology. Well, I should be doing chemical biology. And, you know, that's really, it's in a very, very, very competitive world of science. It's always good to have somebody you can follow. So let's start. I'd like to start talking a little bit about your early career. Because you saw genetics transform itself from classical genetics to molecular biology, but you really came in at the cusp of molecular biology. And then we could talk a little bit about, you know, what attracted you to yeast genetics, maybe go into some of the major discoveries and the important one that we mentioned during the introduction, possibly talk about your CF program. And Dave Brodbeck is an educator at a Canadian university. And maybe we can go into end the show with a little bit about the role of the universities in training our next generation of scientists. So
sounds like a plan.
Yeah. Wow, this is difficult. Yeah, I didn't realize you were going to do this. So I really wanted to be an X-ray crystallographer, and it was just a circumstance after I'd finished a degree in physics and that I actually found out about genetics. I went to a conference just by chance. I thought I was going to a physics conference, but it was actually a genetics conference. I got really interested and got accepted into a lab at University College London that was doing genetics, so I thought. And then they had a very interesting advisor who told me the day after I started that he was leaving for a while. It turned out to be a sabbatical for a year, so I was sort of left on my own. And I really worked with him and other people in the lab on became known as mitochondrial genetics. So this was about the time when DNA had been found in mitochondria, and we started to find genes. And these genes were resistant to antibacterial antibiotics, which was some, not all, which was really interesting because mitochondria had always been thought to be arising from sort of endocytosed eaten bacteria in cells. And so that was that went down very well at that time. A lot of people got very, very interested and excited about it. And then I moved to the National Institute of Medical Research, where I did some sort of biochemistry and genetics around mitochondria. And I did a lot of other things, too. I went to work with Mike Smith, Ben Hall, to try and clone the first eukaryotic gene. I spent a year in Seattle. It was a wet year, and DNA synthesis in those days didn't work well in the wet. And then a few sort of career turns, and I ended up at the NRC in Ottawa and wondering what to do there. And through a set of circumstances there, we worked on enzymes that turned out to be enzymes that process prohormones in the brain but actually exist in yeast. And that was exciting, too. And then I moved to Montreal, and we started working on a number of things. And one was the MAP kinase cascade. And again, that was a serendipitous thing of having the right people, Malcolm Whiteway, Linda Hagen, Karen Clark in the lab, and then Eckhard Leber. And we established a lot of what is now known as the classical MAP kinase cascade. We cloned a very key enzyme, a protein kinase that we call STE20, the only kinase named after a highway, I believe, in the world. It's the 20 highway that runs through Montreal, which is actually not in very good shape. And we struggled with that for a while, and then we found out that yeast, actually there in yeast, the MAP kinase cascade and the alpha, the heterotrimeric G protein that triggers that off after a signal through the receptor, actually works in a very strange way. It's not the alpha subunit that signals, it's the beta gamma subunit that signals. And it turned out, of course, that that's true for a lot of signaling pathways in mammalian cells, too. So we came up with the order.
Yeah, sure. Dave, because so our audience, while it makes up probably about 40-50% molecular biologists, maybe 20% biochemists, and then there's my dad. So
and my mom.
I'll talk to you, Dad.
Okay, so
Mark's dad.
What is the MAP kinase pathway, and why is it important, and why yeast? And this is critical. I mean, the yeast was an important element of this.
Well, the MAP kinase. The real mystery that kind of, even when I was in Seattle talking to Ed Krebs and Ed Fisher, who found some of the first kinases and got the Nobel Prize for it, they worked on the next floor to where I was working. And I was kind of interested in what they were doing. And what kinases do in cells, and there are lots of kinases in cells, they're actually enzymes that phosphorylate. They take a phosphate group off an ATP and transfer it to another protein, and in some way that protein becomes activated. And I say some way, there are several ways in which it can become activated. And by activated, I mean it can do something else that it wasn't doing before. So it's a way that
like cell... Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
It's a cellular biochemical reaction that attaches big fat chemical molecule onto a protein, causing it to shake up.
And it's not a subtle change in some cases. This is the sort of signal that can drive cells to divide, to differentiate into other cells, to open channels, to communicate with other cells. It's basically the control system, as you would have in a computer. It's the CPU. Okay, it's the way of transferring information from one stream to another. And so protein kinases do this. What was not known was how they have real specificity. So if you can't have one protein running around and phosphorylating, putting groups onto a lot of other proteins in the cell, a kinase, if you did that, and there's some examples of that, this would be chaos. What you have to have is an organization. And what we and other people showed, but it was very nicely shown in yeast because of the awesome genetic tools that we had, was that that cascade, that the way that that kinase is actually organized, is that one kinase phosphorylates another one, activates it, phosphorylates another one, activates it, and then that kinase goes off and does something. So you have like a three-partite control. It's like going through a security system at the airport.
Or like a pyramid scheme of logic gates that keep on triggering a downward cascade of events.
Exactly. So what starts off the cascade...
I get to keep my PhD?
Yeah, during this interview, I might just lose it at the end of this. Yeah, so what starts off the cascade, it differs. In some cases, it's a G-protein coupled receptor, which is the case in yeast. And then something binds to that receptor on the outside of the cell. Then that signal, the receptor transmits it inside the cell through a change in its shape. And that change in shape takes a what is called three proteins, in fact. They're called heterotrimeric G proteins. And these are the things that now control, switch on the MAP kinase cascade. And that's one kind of simple story, but it was a very long story to actually establish. But it was very, very nicely done. It was a beautiful piece of work.
Let me see if I get this right. So you've got this protein. So at the surface of the cell, you've got a protein that's there. It receives an extracellular signal. It then translates that signal information to that initial cascade inside the cell with those three proteins, heterotrimeric. There's three, right? So this is where I lose my PhD. Okay, so, and then introduces that cascade. So you guys discovered the first G-protein coupled receptor in yeast.
No, that was already known through work from, I think it was actually Lee Hartwell, who got the Nobel Prize for cell cycle and studies in yeast. I think he and Linda... let me think. Linda Breeden actually discovered it many years ago. Yeah. Okay. But it was known how it worked. Yeah.
Okay. So then you used yeast to figure out the dip switches, how these interact?
Yeah. So it's a combination of genetics. It's, again, another complicated word called epistasis, but it's deciding what the order of things are. And you can do this very nicely in yeast because you can overexpress certain genes, you can knock other genes out very easily. It's becoming very easy to do this in mammalian cells now with the tools that we have in mammalian cells, but at that time, we're talking about the early 90s, you could only really do these things in yeast.
what's the advantage of doing it in, say, a mammalian cell versus, you know, doing it in yeast? I mean, I think of all the sort of behavior genetics I took, everything was done in fruit flies or mice. But that was because it was about behavior. Is there any real advantage to doing it in a mammalian cell, or, you know, why not just keep using yeast?
You know, yeast has a very stripped down, simple way of doing things. It only has two G protein coupled receptors that respond to signaling peptides, whereas right. mammalian cells has all the ones that you know about through neurobiology, cancer, sure. and whatever. And yeast also doesn't have another form of kinase called a tyrosine kinase, specialized tyrosine kinase. And a lot of those kinases are like HER2, that you will have heard of, are sure. involved in cancer, for example. So certainly yeast doesn't have those. So it's... But if you want to look at a stripped-down version, so to speak, if you want to look at something that is not too complicated, look at yeast.
Right. So the same way that, like, you know, Kandel looked at learning in nematodes and was able to look at something as simple as habituation and, you know the genome about nematode, you're still interested in the very long yeah. run of doing it in people or rats or black-capped chickadees, in my case.
Yeah, the idea of model organisms, Drosophila is a great example. We all learned some genetics, at least, using Drosophila.
For sure.
And it's still a great model for psychobiology, for example. Yeah.
For sure.
So tell us a little bit about how you dissected the cascade of information processing proteins.
How did we do it?
Yeah, well, how did you dissect it?
What we kind of did was we used a very simple kind of technique, and that was really to isolate mutants that were not very good at responding to these secreted peptides. And then these mutants were in the genome, obviously, and they were very laboriously collected at that time. And then we just took a library of yeast genes that we had in a plasmid, in a way an extracellular vehicle of delivering these genes, and we put them back and we restored to the yeast the ability to respond to the peptide or whatever. So this is
quite a
common procedure. Yeah, it's a pheromone, but it's you can actually identify what that gene is. And we were able to do it that way, and we had a number of other sort of tricks as well where we could look at the interactions between proteins, and we could also then, after that, make very specific mutations in proteins. So, and we knew most of the components by that time.
Now, did you guys do it with, ultraviolet, or did you use EMS mutagenesis?
You probably did it with ultraviolet, yeah.
You just light do a sunburn.
We had some EMS mutagenesis. I mean, there was one very nice story, if I may. It was that one of the subunits, one of the cells that didn't respond very well to this extracellular peptide, one of the mutants, we complemented that, we isolated the gene, and we figured out, based upon one sequence, protein sequence that was in the database, and it was the protein sequence for the G protein gamma subunit isolated from bovine rhodopsin. So this is one of the proteins that's responsible for transduction of light in the retina of cows. Okay,
that so was you threw only... a human or a cow library into the oh it was
no,
similar
no, no.
to
no no we just similar. Compared in silico. Okay. our sequence of the predicted protein, and it was very short. It was 108 amino acids, and there was only one other protein in the database at that time, and it was there as a protein because it had been sequenced as a protein. And so based upon that, we called up somebody in Seattle at a company, and we said to this lady, actually, I still remember, could you look at the sequence of, now we know that she had complemented a gene called STEF4 that was already known as mutation in yeast, a sterile mutation. And we knew that she had the sequence of this sitting somewhere on a desk. Well, it turned out it wasn't sitting on her desk. It was sitting on somebody else's desk because we called up four or five times and said, could you look at the sequence? We predict it will be the same as the bovine or similar to the cow G beta subunit. Mm-hmm. And, of course, then we got a call like Sunday night. How did you guys figure that out?
So yeast is related to
one of the nice. No. I mean, it's related enough. All these G alpha, G beta, G gamma subunits of the heterotrimeric G protein are all related in some way. They all look rather similar.
Sure.
But there were very few of those sequences at that time. This was early 90s. So there were very few sequences sitting around. But it was kind of a sweet moment to call somebody up and say, we think we know what you have. And, of course, they'd actually looked at the sequence, and they probably had seen that it was related to the cow sequence but hadn't made the connection. So this is nice. This is a nice way to do science. We had a joint publication in a very prestigious journal on that, I remember. Yeah.
It was an incredible time, the early 90s, especially when you're coming out with these genetics and you're isolating genes that are major molecular pathways. It's kind of like biochemistry, discovering new enzymes all over the place. And it's kind of like, you know, the one thing that was great is you do your DNA sequencing, you'd run that gel just like on X-Files, which they could do in 2 hours while we did it in 4 and 8, put them in the freezer for the radioactivity to really intensify the signal on your film, come back on Monday morning and look at your DNA sequences. And it was an incredible time for discovery.
Or you went in on Sunday night to get a jump on the week. Yeah, it was actually very exciting to do those things. Now we just send our DNA away to be sequenced. I'm not even sure where it's done right now. Yeah,
in your lab. I bought a DNA sequencer while I was in your lab, Dave.
No, we don't even use that. Now we can't afford to run it.
Oh, boy. That was fun, man.
We send them away. And actually, oligonucleotide synthesis, that year I spent in Seattle and Vancouver trying to synthesize an oligo, now we get them made, by the hundreds.
I'll translate that. You get DNA made. Somebody makes it.
Online. Yeah.
Now, the chat room's wondering where my quote was. Now, this is kind of a hidden Easter egg. There was a quote from Blade Runner in my questioning. Does anybody know? Okay, so for the chat room, when I asked him, did you try EMS mutagenesis? That's when the Blade Runner goes up to Torell Corporation and asks them, is there any way you can mutate me back into having a longer lifespan? So anyway, that was my little insider quote. It was really fun. And that's what I thought was cool about being in the lab, is you guys had some of the stuff that Torell Corporation had.
Yeah. We still do. Only it's, as I said, it's moved on. Science, the circus has moved on. Now we're into other machines. Yeah.
Well, when I was in your lab, when we first moved over to McGill, we did buy a DNA sequencer, and you said, okay, go for it and get a capillary DNA sequencer, one that could actually sequence DNA and put it up on a server, and then you'd be from home, you could collect your data. The thing is, they shipped it. It was a $125,000 machine. They shipped it. It had Windows on it, and Windows wouldn't boot. Yeah. I thought, wow, this is like getting a Ferrari and they putting the keys in.
That's awesome.
But it's the wrong keys. And I was just, so I didn't get to see it run.
Now we just send it away for $5 a run. You know, it's crap.
Absolutely. And now there's no reason not to sequence everything. Anytime you're doing an experiment, you've got to sequence it. There's just no reason not to.
Yeah.
Dave, I'm going to ask you to move your mic up a little bit towards your nose.
I just had it coughed.
All right.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, good. So, so you did a lot of work deciphering some of the major signaling pathways in yeast. And these pathways are conserved in mammalian cells?
Yeah.
But they're homologous. What kind of processes do they control in a mammalian cell?
Well, you know, just about everything. You know, I just went to a recruiting seminar, and we had somebody talking about differentiation of B cells, for example, of cells producing immunoglobulins. They're involved there. These kind of cascades work just about anything to take a signal from the outside of the cell, to take it in and do something with it within the cell. So it sometimes it's to make new genes. Sometimes it's to move things around within cells. Sometimes it's literally to set off channels that open in cells. So there are a whole bunch of different channels to bring in solutes or export solutes. Soluble compounds from cells. So they're used ubiquitously. It's a very common way of cells responding to their environment. It's not the only one, but there are quite a few.
Now, this might be a little bit of insider baseball, and Dave, you might want to stop us the other day.
Yeah.
So can the signaling pathways be targeted as drug targets? And have they, and are there any examples?
Sure. So the paradigm in the drug industry was that you inhibited very far up in a pathway. That is, these G protein coupled receptors, these proteins sitting on outside of the cells, there are on a lot of compounds designed to either inhibit or to activate these G protein coupled receptors. And the paradigm was that the further down you went in the pathway, or the thought was, the further you went down in the pathway, like a MAP kinase cascade, the less specificity you would have. That
really
turned out not to be true. It turned out to be, in fact, intuitively you wouldn't even think it was true, but that was part of the dogma. And now we have kinase inhibitors produced by for a lot of the kinases individually, and some are not very selective. So there was a company, Sugen, that produced a lot of different inhibitors for these kinases. They're called serine threonine kinases, and these compounds are extremely useful research tools. There are a few which have made it into the clinic. One of the postdocs in the lab, Bert Klebel, went to work with a company called U3 in Munich. And he now heads up a Max Planck in Dortmund, and he actually was working on inhibitors of kinases, serine threonine kinases, for infectious diseases, in fact.
I remember Bert. Bert was an incredible guy. He could run like 20K after drinking.
He ran to the lab every day. Yes,
right. And he lived like 20 miles away. And I ran side by side with him, and you could hear he could drink so much water, and it would gurgle while he ran. It was just really amazing, intense guy.
One of our students here just went for a job with him. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. I want to talk a little bit about protein folding. Let's switch the gears from signaling in yeast and how yeast, I mean, that was a little bit about how yeast can be used as a tool to really dissect major biological processes. But let's talk a little bit of protein folding, because this is a key. You made a key discovery. It was with Wei Jia Wu and John Bergeron back in the early 90s. Tell us a little bit about Kelnexin and what you guys found and how it relates to the current work that you're doing, because you're trying to tackle a major disease, and this is how it started, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's how it started, but in fact, it has very little relationship right now to what we're doing. But the Calnexin story is great. I'd known John Bergeron since we both worked together at Mill Hill, the National Institute for Medical Research in London. And he came to me with actually Ikuo Wada, a Japanese postdoc, and what they had found were proteins in the endoplasmic reticulum, that's part of the cell that's involved in secretory proteins and making proteins that are secreted out of the cell, insulin being a great example. So they had found these proteins that were the substrates, that is, they received phosphorus from kinases. And he said, could we identify these proteins? So Ikuo came to the lab, and Ikuo's great guy to have in the lab. And after some false starts, we were able to identify four of these proteins. One of them turned out to be a protein that turned out to have a lot of similarity to another protein that had been found by a postdoc in the lab. And that protein was called calreticulin. And this had been found in, I think it was in cows again.
Steak.
Begin to realize we have a lot to do with animals here. And what happened was that Ekkehard had found calreticulin. And essentially at that time, they were unable to establish using the tools in cell biology and biochemistry what it was really doing. And Calnexin, we call this new protein Calnexin in homage to calreticulin. We kind of looked at it, and it was very similar. I thought at first that we'd got some contamination coming into the lab from Ekkehard, but that turned out not to be true. It was just a homologue, a protein that looked like calreticulin. And we were able to make antibodies to this. But I think my comment to John Bergeron at the time was, well, you'll spend the rest of your career figuring out what this does. Enter Weizhou Wu, and with Ikuo and other people in the lab, we made good antibodies to Calnexin. That turned out to be the key for everything. And we were able to show, and to much skepticism at the time, that if you immunoprecipitated Calnexin and looked...
Let's define what that is. That's using an antibody.
If you took an antibody, to recognize that protein and pull it out of a lyse cell, a cellular gamish, a cell that had been lysed, and do an experiment which is called a pulse chase experiment. We were able, and I won't go into the details of that, but it's like throwing a bunch of yellow ducks into the river, okay? Mm-hmm. If you go to the nearest river, throw a bunch of yellow ducks in and tell somebody a mile downstream there's some ducks coming past. And essentially what you do in cells is to put in not yellow ducks, but isotopes, a radioisotope that will label new proteins, and it will pass through the cell and do whatever those proteins do. So what we were able to show was that Calnexin interacts in a transient fashion with proteins going through the cell. And not only that, it interacted, and these proteins were going to go outside the cell, they're going to be secreted. It interacted only with proteins that had a sugar signal on them. And based on then on some pretty heavy duty biochemistry and getting the sequence of the structure of this protein, finding out what that protein interacted with, a little bit like the same sort of way that we worked on the MAP kinase cascade, only these are not kinases. We were able to show that Calnexin interacts very specifically with one special form of this sugar, the coat that is present on proteins. And what's more, if that protein wasn't folded correctly, Calnexin will keep binding to that protein. It's known now as the Calnexin cycle. Many other people have worked on it, made some great contributions. It's involved in immunity. It's involved in sensitivity to viruses. It's involved in genetic diseases like cystic fibrosis. So this
protein is there as proteins are being made and secreted in the cell. There's sort of, it's like a fundamental, honestly, what attracted me to joining the group was that you were working on a fundamental process of protein folding. So yeah. this really is a key aspect that makes it interesting to everybody and so fundamental to all those diseases, which perhaps you could explain how those occur.
Yeah.
But it's really central to protein folding and secretion of all proteins that end up on the cell surface and get secreted, right?
Precisely, Mark. Yeah, it's a little bit like if you think about a production line, if you think about the quality control steps there. So what it does is if the automobile is not assembled correctly, it holds it in the line until something comes along and repairs it. So Calnexin would be like the gatekeeper there, or the line foreman who says, okay, let's stop this model here, let's get this right, and let's let it move on. So Calnexin sort of is that sort of gatekeeper, if you like. And it has with its buddies the way of being able to recognize unfolded proteins, and it retains them until they're repaired. If they're not repaired, there's another mechanism that says, let's take this out of the line and destroy it. And so Calnexin and these sugar modifications on proteins specify that too. So if the protein is irreparable, can't be folded, it is removed from this endoplasmic reticulum, this compartment in the cell for secretory proteins, and degraded in the by another system called the proteasomal system that we can talk about later.
What if your protein, for example, is like a pair of pants, right? And the button on the back of the pair of pants is not there, but it's mm-hmm. still a good pair of pants, right?
Right. Okay.
Wouldn't you want that pair of pants rather than be running around without a pair of pants? Well,
yeah. So here's the clue. I mean that a lot of proteins, and we'll talk about cystic fibrosis in a moment, are in fact pretty good proteins. This quality control system is pretty stringent, and even some of the good proteins are recognized by this quality control system. So it's set at a very high gain, if you like, and it is an extremely fine mesh that you have to get through to get outside the cell. So it's set at a very high level. So a lot of proteins which would be functional if they could get to their destination in the cell are in fact recognized and degraded by this quality control system, of which the Calnexin cycle is the major part, or the main component. So that's how we got into cystic fibrosis. So cystic fibrosis, first, is a genetic disease, of course, identified by groups in Michigan and the University of Toronto 20 years ago. And then there's a gene called CFTR, cystic fibrosis transmembrane regulator, which is a cell surface gene, the cell surface protein involved in the transport of chloride. And the most common mutation, it's a deletion of one codon, it's a deletion of one amino acid, actually retains that protein in the endoplasmic reticulum by the Calnexin cycle, okay? So, here's the key experiment, and this is a great experiment. We didn't do it. My colleague John Hanrahan and other people did it. If you actually take the RNA coding for this protein and put it into Xenopus X, this is a standard sort of neuro or cell physiology experiment. The protein is made and goes to the cell surface. So you have a little egg. It was about 3 or 4 millimeters across. And these are used a lot. So Xenopus is the South African. It's called a toad. It's actually a frog, but whatever. So they did this experiment. They did it with the wild-type protein, goes to the cell surface. They did it with the mutant protein. The messenger RNA for the mutant protein went to the cell surface. So what's going on here? So, of course, frogs and toads live at room temperature. And you and I live at 37 degrees. Okay. And, of course, what it turned out was this mutation is a temperature-sensitive mutation. So if you take a cell, a human cell, expressing cystic fibrosis, the cystic fibrosis mutation, the common mutation, you drop the temperature, then the protein goes to the cell surface where it's more or less functional. So lots of people have done this experiment. It really works. So our question was, could we get compounds that actually mimic that low temperature and allow that protein to go to the cell surface? And the additional hypothesis was, well, there's going to be something involved in this Kallnexian cycle. So I'll tell you the short story is none of them. The good news is we isolated lots of correctors, and we're working with a major pharmaceutical company on one set of these correctors right now. The bad news for the Kallnexian cycle is none of them work on the Kallnexian cycle as far as we can tell. They work.
Well, maybe that's a good thing, right? Because why tinker with something so central to the cell?
Well, that's a good point. Actually, you're always good at finding some optimistic side to things. It would have been really sweet if we could have got it, an inhibitor of the Kallnexian cycle, of which we know a lot and a lot about the inhibitors. And
you cure 120 diseases at a time because there's 120 diseases similar to this or more.
There are probably more. There are somebody, I was talking to some of you, orphan diseases the other day, some of our clinicians here, and they said there are actually about 7,000 now orphan diseases that are known. Some are diseases of, families of, 4 or 5 people. But there are an orphan disease in the U.S. is a disease that affects less than 200,000 people. So cystic fibrosis is one of those diseases. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most common ones. But in total of those 7,000 diseases, there are actually millions of people, probably 20 million people, that actually have an orphan disease. It's just that in some cases they're lethal. In many cases they're not. Other examples of trafficking diseases are things like Gaucher's disease, Pompe's disease, Fabry's disease, which are diseases of the lysosomal disorders. And again, they are proteins which have been which go through the secretory pathway, but in this case, they're retained in a special organelle within the cell.
Sure. So let me just try to summarize this a little bit.
Yeah.
And well, see if I understand. I hope I understand because this is what my PhD thesis was.
Yeah, yeah.
And right. Let me explain it to my father.
We can do a recall if you like.
At this point, Mark. You have it. Okay. Yeah. Let's explain it to Dave Brodbeck. So here you've got a situation where proteins are being made in the cell by a fundamental cell synthesis pathway. Those proteins are getting made. They're nascent. They're getting folded. This machinery, the Kallnexian cycle, is a series of proteins that go and bind to it, bind to the sugar moiety of those proteins, stabilize them so that they can fold and not collapse while they're folding, and then send them off to the right part of the cell where they're going to do their job. Right. And if a protein like the delta F508 is missing the phenylalanine at position 508 on cystic fibrosis, if you're missing that little, you've got that slight mutation, mm-hmm. while the channel can fold and assemble, Kallnexian cycle recognizes it as defective and sends it off for degradation. And there's a large number of diseases that follow the same fundamental mechanism. So that's pretty much the gist of it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But if you could control that folding cycle, you could
directly... No, that makes sense. That makes sense. I got it.
Great. Maybe you want to have a sabbatical?
I think I could use one, I'll tell you. That's a whole other matter, though.
But you know, the home of the Habs.
Yeah. So, anyway, so we're on our way. There are there are a lot of efforts in Europe, in the U.S. Now to get what is called correctors of protein trafficking for cystic fibrosis and for other diseases. I think it's a really exciting time. You know, my mom always wanted me to go to medical school. I didn't figure that I would be here teaching medical students. But anyway, it makes my mom happy. But she does say, why don't you cure diseases instead of working on yeast? Yeah, right.
Well, that's perhaps why you transitioned from running a yeast genetics lab to going to a biochemistry department, which is, I find, a little weird for the biochem department to say, yeah, we want to be led by a yeast geneticist, right? That was
Didn't realize I didn't know any biochemistry, yeah. But I think they figured it out pretty fast.
That's okay.
Mark, I can tell you also as a department chair that it's not really so much leading as it is herding cats. It's not, academics are not the, I don't know about you, Dave, but I do everything through equation. That's all I got. Yeah. And smiles.
I have great colleagues and, we don't need, they're self-motivated. Let's put it that way. And, yeah. It's really a great department, great environment. Yeah.
So let me ask one last question on the CF issue. So you've mm-hmm. got robots running tests on to look for proteins, molecules that can restore the trafficking. So you really think, this is where you're putting your money, is looking for molecules that can stabilize a temperature sensitive defect in the CFTR channel.
Here we go. This is okay. So this is another great surprise. Okay, so we have a few molecules that do that they bind to the CFTR mutant protein and help it get to the cell surface. So this is a well-known kind of phenomenon, ligand stabilization of proteins. Okay.
Yep.
And it's being used now in, let's say, Gaucher's disease, where you take a pseudo substrate, that is something that looks like it would normally be acting, and this will help the protein traffic, in this case, intracellularly to the lysosome. In the case of cystic fibrosis, here's the problem we have right now is we have these compounds that correct extremely well, us and other people too, other companies and other academic labs too. We actually don't know how they work. They do not bind directly to the CF protein. We know that. But how they work is working on some aspect of the cell quality control machinery that is not the Calnexin cycle. Not that part of it. So this is the exciting part, and we're going at it right now with all the tools that we have now for mammalian, looking at things in mammalian cells, mm-hmm. knocking down genes, overexpressing genes, cross-linking proteins to small molecules, things like this. So the lab is a full blast doing these things right now. With a lot of great collaborators, I should say, both in companies and we have a collaboration with a superb chemist on the West Coast who spends his life diving to get corals that have interesting, new, exciting chemicals. And we have one out of that. That's Ray Anderson at UBC. And we have chemist collaborators around the world that we're working with on this as well. So that's an exciting part of what we're doing. And we have a mouse model that was developed by a group in Amsterdam for cystic fibrosis. These mice, we flew over first class on KLM, and they eat a special, because they get meconium ileus, which cystic fibrosis patients also get when they're young. We have to feed them a special, very expensive diet. And it tastes pretty good, too. Yeah.
Oh, the mice? Oh, the diet. The
diet.
Nice.
It's called a Danish seafood diet. It's a high-protein diet. Yeah.
Wow. So that has been one of the major issues with CF, right? Is really getting a good animal model that you can test your drugs.
Yeah. In effect, what we're doing right now is the mouse model is nice. The problem is they don't develop the lung CF. They develop a mostly in the gut. And we have another test which measures salivary secretion, which tells us if our corrector compounds are working. But we've been collecting cells. I mean, the wonderful thing about working with this is the families and the patients themselves are, you know, very, very educated in what the disease is and what it needs. So we have a collection network of cells from patients. We get from transplants, we get lungs. Mm-hmm. When patients get transplants, we get the lungs. We have a team that goes out and dissects out the part of the lungs that we need, and we put these cells into culture. So that part has worked fantastically well. It's we're able to collect lungs and also get what is called nasal scrapings from patients. It's not as painful as it sounds. And we're able to collect cells there, collect cells from them, and be able to test some of these compounds and methods on these patients.
I'm doing my best to keep up. with your drug discovery program.
I mean, there's a huge network here. You know, it's not just me. It's a superb group. It was never just me. There's a superb group of people, of colleagues and students and postdocs who are able to take over significant, really responsible parts of this project.
You talk about students, Dave, and postdocs, and I mean, of course, we all did that as well. If you're going to get graduate students at some point, do you think like the way undergraduate education is done in things as cutting edge as the kind of stuff that you're working on, do you think that undergraduates are prepared to deal with it, or is it something more that really that's just for graduate students?
We just had going away lunch for our summer students here, and it's amazing how sophisticated they are. I must say, I was very, you know, so they've all been doing small projects around some of the things I've been describing, and right. they're really well informed. I mean, they're superb. In a way, this sort of production line thing would probably go on better in a biotech company. But even at a university, you can see the value of being part of a team, how it prepares people for graduate school. I'm talking about the undergraduates that we've just had. And just the experience of, I mean, one graduate student said, well, all I did last summer was, and he mentioned an experiment, RT-PCR. It worked every time. He said, nothing worked this summer. And I said, so where do you think you learned the most? He said, well, because, you know, we would go through and do the post-mortem on the experiments. He said, I think I learned a lot. I learned a lot [S2] Right. [S1] Of different things from, you know, just doing the same old thing that works every time. So I think there's a lot to be said for a varied experience, you know, spend 4 months on something that doesn't work.
Yeah. I mean, I remember being an INSERC summer student twice, yeah. Which is what convinced me to go to graduate school. And I mean, to me, it was one of the most incredible experiences of my life, because I suddenly realized that I wasn't running someone else's experiment. I was running something that belonged to me.
Yeah.
And it actually changed my life. It literally did. I remember saying to a friend of mine, if I ever ended up running rats in an experiment, mm-hmm. Shoot me. And I mean, happily, my friend John lives in Calgary and doesn't own a gun. But you know, it's one of these cases where, I mean, it's so such a valuable experience for you know an undergrad. On the other hand, I mean, can people step into the kind of work that you do from a somewhat general background? I mean, do they have to have a pretty specialized undergrad degree, or someone, let's say, with a 4-year honors degree in biology or chemistry, step into your lab as a master's student?
Or do you prefer physicists? Yeah, we have a new student just arrived, new graduate student. Yeah, I mean, it's what we're looking at right now. We have a guy with an engineering degree from France, Strasbourg, who's doing some of the informatics. We have a microbiologist who's just joined us, who has a very good statistical background. I mean, you know, there's lots of sorts of skills that you like to see. Right. And I keep saying in the department, when we're hiring, we should not try and clone ourselves. We should be looking, and maybe that's why you have a geneticist in charge of a biochemistry department, is that, you know, you kind of have to look at the holistic view of what we're trying to do. So the department, we have a cancer center in the department. We have a CF center now. We have a complex genetic traits, and we have a structural biology group. So at least 4 major groups in the department. So we're pretty diverse. And maybe that's the way science is going, is that you have to have a lot of different skills now.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe that's why I'm here, because I'm interested in lots of different things. We used to call it lack of focus. now it's called interdisciplinarity.
That's right.
Let me jot that one down.
Yeah. No, that's what you call it on your insert forms, Mark. It's interdisciplinary.
Insert forms? No, you mean DC, you know, what I call white papers to VCs.
Oh, yeah.
Or executive summaries, yeah.
Yeah, I have degrees in biology, physics, and genetics. So I can actually collaborate with myself and be interdisciplinary. Yeah.
Nice.
Well, I was always trying to figure out how you organize your ideas, Dave, because you do cover a broad range of stuff. It's been a great experience for me, and I appreciate the time you spent.
It was a lot of fun, actually. It's a lot of fun moving here. Yeah.
We've got to go because there's another show coming up. Tech News Today is coming up. I'd like to thank you very much. Dr. Dave Thomas, professor and chair of Department of Biochemistry at McGill University, Canada Research Chair in Molecular Genetics, and fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. Thanks for coming on, Dave. This is amazing.
Thanks a lot, Mark. Thank you, Dave, for moderating this. Great talking to you.
Thanks a lot.
You've got a lot of courage taking on major unmet medical needs and tackling genetic disease.
I think some people would say it's stupidity, but we're having a lot of fun.
Awesome. So thanks again for coming on. Thank you also, Dave, for Dave Broadbeck.
Boy, my video is awful.
Associate Professor and Chair, Department of Psychology at Algoma University, and host of a number of podcasts. Which one would you like to mention first?
Tangential convergence, which is when where me and 2 friends talk about technology, science, and history, and how they, and then we go off on tangents, and then it converges. That's hence the name. That's at tangentialconvergence.com. So,
okay, cool, good. You've also got a whole network of shows. So, Dave Broadbeck on Google will get you to a whole bunch.
And at Dave Broadbeck on Twitter. Yep.
Yeah, and if you want an education, he's got a whole bunch of psych classes too. So he'll tell you a little bit about the human mind.
I do what I can.
Thanks again for coming on and helping me out with the interview. I'd also like to. Oh, sorry, we've got a delay. We've got about a 1-second delay right now. I'd like to thank Burke McQuinn for handling audio video boards and for the recordings today and helping us with his patience with getting Dave and getting over our technical difficulties early on in the show. I'd like to thank our producer, Eric Lanigan, and also the team that make this possible, Leo Laporte, Lisa Kentzel, Tony Wang, Frederic Louis, Mike Taylor, John Slanina, Jemmer B, and Ken Shepherdson, and everyone else at in Petaluma, California. Lastly, I'd like to thank Phil Peltier and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. If you have any suggestions or comments, you can email me at mark@twit.tv. It's mark@twit.tv. If there's anything else, tune in next show. We're having David Botstein from Princeton. He is a yeast geneticist as well, but he's focusing on a new institute. And so to find out more, tune in on the 10th. We go live at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 12:30 p.m. Pacific. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.